This is the August 6th edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Arlen Suderman. He's at StoneX. That used to be FC Stone at StoneX.com. Jackie Vakes is with us from Total Farm Marketing. She's in Hollister, Missouri at TotalFarmMarketing.com. And Mike Zuzlo is at GlobalComResearch.com. That's Global Commodities Research. GlobalCom with two M's, research.com. Let's get started here with a list of items that maybe we should discuss for the day. Arlen Suderman, what's on your list?
Well, I would say that what's mattering right now in the markets is the supply side of the equation, and that's the private yield estimates coming out, which we kicked off the start of those this last week, and there have been some others as well. What's happening with China, and will it buy enough corn to offset that or not is another question. And then receiving very little attention, I think it's very good news for the grain industry, was a court decision late last month, and maybe you've covered it already, give a stay on the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that was a big relief to farmers.
I have not covered it other than I knew that they did that, so we'll come back and talk to you about that one. Jackie Vakes from Total Farm Marketing, on your list?
Well, of course, South America, always on my list. China, definitely on my list. And concerns about China, I think it would be a better way of saying it, more than just straight China. And Ireland hit it. I mean, you know, when you look at the supplies, it just doesn't seem like we're going to get smaller. It seems like we're going to get bigger. And so those are big concerns for farmers.
And Mike Zuzla, GlobalCom Research.
I think the only other thing I'd touch on, Todd, is the equity markets and the gold record highs and how those fit in, and watching those real closely here in the next 30 to 45 days.
Jackie Vakes, I'll start with you. Let's talk a little bit about next week's crop production figures. That has to do, of course, with supply, but what are the expectations and your thoughts as to how USDA will manage this August report?
Well, I think it's going to be, it could be what you would call a non-report. In other words, most everything is going to be into the market. Like Arlen said, you know, StoneX has been out. FACE, you know, formerly Informa, has been out with numbers varying anywhere from the bean number, definitely higher than what the USDA is at, the corn number higher at StoneX and slightly higher at FACE. You know, so I think that when we get that far, we'll already have all of this. So it's going to take a big divergence off of this to actually cause any major problems or any big changes. It could be the point that maybe puts a bottom into this market, perhaps. But it's going to be an interesting report. Normally, we don't see any acreage changes, even though we're hearing higher acreages in some places. But I don't know. You know, you try to talk to farmers about what's going on, and they prefer to be focused on the fields rather than on marketing, it seems like, at this point, because of where the levels are. And so maybe next week will help us out.
Arlen, can you tell me a little bit about the numbers that StoneX developed and how that comes about? And I don't know if you want to take up those numbers as they compare to USDA, I'm sure you do, or to FACE, which is the old Informa company.
Yeah, what we do is we survey our customers and say, in your area, if you had to pick a number right now, what you think the final, not the August number, but the final, what you think the final yield will be. And granted, that's hardest on soybeans since the critical month of August is ahead of us yet on August 1st. What do you think the final yield will be? We put it all together into an estimate, and we came up with 182.4 bushels for corn and 54.2 for soybeans. That's 2.2% above trend for the corn. So that's not that far above trend. We're just not used to 180 plus yields. So that's why it's kind of eye-popping. The soybean number was eye-popping to me, that people would be willing to go that high in their responses, even though we have the critical month of August ahead of us. That says a lot about how they feel their soybeans look right now, and I think speaks with a lot of confidence. And I've been surprised at how many farmers I've had respond to me on social media where it's taboo to talk about high yield. yields and say, I think you're too low.
So, Mike, listening to that and considering the conversations that you've had with producers, are they really of a mind to talk about extraordinarily high yields?
Yeah, I've had the exact opposite reaction since Stone's numbers came out. And, you know, I've always appreciated their numbers, and I think they do a wonderful job. But I am getting an opposite reaction in states, you know, as close to you as North Central Indiana. Even Nebraska clients are telling me that they're going to have a really good crop, but it's not going to be as good as last year. I think when I look at the state-by-state numbers and knowing that they're polling people with a final yield mindset, not an August yield mindset, it's quite surprising to see Iowa as high as it is, Nebraska as high as it is, and Ohio as high as it is. And I'd throw on top of that Minnesota. And I think, generally speaking, the biggest issue that I find right now, and it reminds me of 2016 quite a bit, and I'm wondering whether this isn't a similar type market year like 2016, where we made a major low in that August-September time period and then ground ourselves out of it going all the way into the third quarter of 2017. But there's a real serious discrepancy between crop conditions and drought monitor. And I don't use the drought monitor, I don't use the crop conditions at all anymore on my yield estimates, because they did me really wrong the last few years. And I think the drought monitor, however, and some of the PCAD moisture data that support the drought monitor would suggest that, given that you've got, you know, Iowa at almost 80% drought, Nebraska at 55% drought, Ohio at almost 80% drought, and Minnesota at almost 40% drought, I myself can't get above a 180 or a 179.5 on my top end range. And I'm right at a 2017 year yield of 176.6, 176.7. That's the highest we've seen in the last 5 years. And the issue even in Illinois, as I talk to producers in Morgan County, telling me that it looks really good, the population's really there, but they're really getting a substantial amount of tip back. And that's where the 2016 mindset comes into play for me, that it maybe it was there, but I don't think it is by the time we get to the harvest.
Does anybody recall what the CME group number was for corn? It was very low, like 174.6. That would be on the very low end of the marketplace. I'll see if I can find that. Just a note, I double-checked that number. It's actually 174.84, and it was from Bar Chart. That's owned by CME Group. Their national soybean yield was at 49.2. Exactly how this August crop production report goes these days, but I'm pretty certain that it will be mostly or almost all survey-based rather than field site-based. From your survey of farmers, it sounds like this could be a big number that would come out of producers. And I would have thought maybe that they might have given or could be giving USDA a much smaller number.
Well, what's interesting is we know that USDA also takes to farmer numbers and tends to raise them up or adjust them upward, too, because they say the farmer tends to understate yields. But I think this is a good discussion. It's a discussion we have every year. Sometimes we're on the low end saying that they should be lower, and sometimes now this year we're on the higher end. And that's the fun of the job that we've each been doing for many, many years. But what USDA will be doing for this report is, as you mentioned, the farmer surveys, yes, but they will also be doing their modeling, and they will be using satellite data as well and putting that all into a yield. And I think that makes the August report the biggest wild card of the year, perhaps, because each of those systems have their own unique set of flaws. So USDA has some real challenges without walking the fields and making that adjustment this time around.
Jackie Vakes, you've been listening to this conversation as it relates how USDA collects the data, what the report might look like, and the survey-based numbers. Where do you think it will come in?
I think it's going to come in on a higher side. I agree with Arlen. I think that, well, the guys I've been talking to in Nebraska are telling me that some of them have the potential for the highest production they've ever had on farms, which is kind of shocking. 246, 250 on average on 5,000 acres. It's scary is what it is. I think when you look at, you know, you and I have been talking about trend line comparisons. This last week was just such a huge change in the states that moved to above trend line. And therefore, I think that in general, the USDA is probably going to make their, they're going to be a little less likely to go on the shorter side. I think they'll probably go to a little bit higher number. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if it comes in significantly higher than what we think it's going to.
Arlen, you suggested we probably ought to talk about these corn purchases that USDA has made, or that the Chinese have made, and what the expectations might look like going forward. What have you been thinking about?
Well, we've been raising attention to the deficit spending, so to speak, in the corn balance sheet in China for several years, how they've been consuming 25 to 30 million metric tons more than they've been producing. Our reserve numbers, and we have sources very close to reserve, have been lower than USDA for quite some time. In our conversations with USDA, that's been kind of a difference of opinion there. And based on our numbers now, their reserve, their temporary reserve, I should say, they have two reserves, their temporary reserve that they kind of do the in and out flow out of, only has about 3 weeks of supply left in it. And the cash prices there are from the mid $8 range to mid $9 range in southern areas of the country. So they do have a perceived really tight position right now, and they can buy U.S. corn, ship it to the port. It's about $6.10 per bushel, and put it into the reserve, blend it with lower quality corn, and then sell it at auction, and the government can make quite a profit. So why wouldn't they do it? That's the argument for major imports. The other argument, though, that our Shanghai office reminds us of is that China doesn't really have an incentive to do so, other than that financial incentive. One of their primary goals is to elevate the incomes of the rural poor, and they can do that best with high corn prices. And you say, well, that leads to food inflation, but it really doesn't, because of African swine fever, pork prices are so high, hog margins are feeding margins around $350 and up per pig. High corn prices are not the limiting factor. African swine fever is the limiting factor. So it's not contributing to higher food prices right now. It's helping pay for the rural poor, put income in the rural poor. And so I think the focus is first going to be on increasing supply. I do expect them to do some modest increases in corn imports, but not the big grand slam that we'd like to see until they see that they just can't elevate their yields as much as what they would like. But we'll have to see. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope they do really open the door to imports.
Have you done similar analysis for their soybean and bean meal needs?
Yes. We've talked to our people on the ground in Shanghai, and really kind of baffled at the soy meal demand there. We know the demand is high because of increased chicken production. They've been able to increase chicken production at a much faster rate than what we thought, because a lot of these small rural hog farms that had a few hogs switched to chickens as their income source. So they've really increased that. And they've increased the inclusion rate of protein in their diets too, to get the income as fast as they can at these high margin rates before they happen to get African swine fever. But still, the meal seems to be disappearing faster than what we expected, even faster than what's justified by the rate of return of the hog industry. But it is happening. And that's why we're seeing them not only import a lot of beans for that, but they're also importing a lot of beans, front-loaded their Brazilian demand, and now front-loading U.S. demand, because they are convinced that they handled coronavirus better than anybody else in the world, and yet their ports shut down, their supply lines shut down. So if they handled coronavirus better than anyone else and that happened to them, they are convinced that that's eventually going to happen to Brazil and United States. And so they're trying to get imported as much as they can before that happens. Our people on the ground there hear almost daily talk about that among the buyers. So that's a factor. And also the factor of the fear that the governments might just be so angry with each other that they shut off imports and they want to get as much in as they can before that happens.
And then Mike Suslow, I want to follow up with this on the equity markets, the U.S. dollar, and kind of the macro econ across the planet that you've been watching.
Yeah, and you know, just for disclaimer compliance sake, I don't have a securities license, so the only kind of license that I have is a commodities license. So I'm talking about futures when it comes to the S&P 500, Todd, but the gap in the chart above the market has been filled, and that was one of the key technical indicators for this market for me to start to get on the watch, to get some hedges in place in equity holdings using some E-mini S&P futures and options here in the next 30 to 45 days, maybe as soon as the next 10 days. It really depends on the vaccination issue and how quickly and how successfully a vaccine can be put out. And I think this is the rub that I see right now. Not only the technicals are overdone, but we have a record high gold price. So you have a near the highs in equities markets, even though the corn's trading 5 cents from its COVID low from back in April, March. And then you have a record high gold price. And to me, those two things can't continue, that you have the equity markets building in a positive vaccine, but you have the gold market building in the fear that the vaccine's not going to work. And so somebody's going to be wrong. And I think that's where you really want to keep track of the charts and keep track of the equities markets. And then wrapped up into both of those is the election and the November election. And, you know, when we were talking about higher prices a month ago and a wheat low being made and being able to get above the 355 level in December corn and making hedges, the main reason I was talking about making hedges and not going along was because of the uncertainty of the vaccination issue and the election as well. And so this factors into the equities markets as well as the gold market. But as far as I'm concerned, the grain markets have limited, if any, risk premium in them whatsoever, unless USDA comes out with something on the 12th that is totally out of the range of what the trade was thinking. Because I think at this point, we're pricing in close to a 3.4 billion bushel carryover in the corn at this price level of 310.
Jackie Vakes, when we talked on Wednesday of this week during the closing market report, you suggested that the Chinese might be front-loading their purchases. Arlen mentioned this as well. Why do you think that may be the case?
Well, you know, Todd, we've seen it happen before. We saw them front-load soybeans 2 years ago and then just shut it off. We've seen them front-load corn, shut it off. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. It's a way that they can control price. And I think the timing would probably be right along with when we start to harvest, and especially if we have a large crop, because they would like to buy at the cheapest prices they possibly can. I mean, they've got problems over there. Arlen was talking about, you know, the hog situation. This flood situation is pretty severe in terms of causing logistics problems in the south. And so my mantra, as long as I've done this job, is I never trust China. And I never put any big hopes on the fact that they will continue to do what they're doing or do what they say they're going to do, that we always have to be prepared that they may just go, and I always call it a China put, you know, if that's the case. But I think that in general, I just don't have any great feeling for what they may do. I mean, when you look at the whole situation, Todd, as far as the relationship between China and the U.S. right now, the fact that they're buying so aggressively just goes against that completely. So that's some of my thinking and how I feel about it. I just don't think that we have the right to assume that this is going to continue to go on. And when Mike said we're trading at 3.4 and there's not much volatility in the market, I'd agree. But boy, I'll tell you what, if you looked at option premiums on corn, especially on corn this week, when corn took a drop, corn call options just dove and lost value like crazy. So there was some premium put in there, but there's nothing there anymore. So I think that if we do get anything that's positive, we could see some decent volatility come back into this market.
Arlen, this is a supply-driven marketplace. What does that tell you about the things producers need to think about as they go into the harvest season this fall?
Well, I think this makes it more critical than ever, and we've been hearing this and saying this for three, four decades now. but it really becomes important to spend a little bit of time putting some numbers down on paper, really know what your break-evens are. And high yields do tend to lower your cost per bushel. And so that makes it look a little bit better, give you a little bit better feeling about selling when we do get rallies and we do get opportunities. Don't try to get the home run, but look for a lot of singles and doubles. We're starting to play baseball again. Let's look for singles and doubles. Watch basis volatility. Again, Mike brought up earlier some of the macroeconomic factors. When I look at M1 money supply, we didn't top $1 trillion till 1992, I believe it was. 9 years later, we hit $2 trillion. A few years later, $3 trillion. In February, we were at $4 trillion. In the last few months, we've jumped to $5.3 trillion. And M2 money supply has exploded even more than that. There's a tremendous amount of money in the system. At some point, that's going to create inflation. It's already, as mentioned, hit the gold market. It's helping elevate the equities, I think. We could see larger moves in the grains than what the fundamentals could justify at some point. When? I don't know. Will it be this year? I don't know. But if we do, you could get rapid deterioration of basis. You could get growth in the spreads. Rapid changes in the spreads, I should say. But look for opportunities to make some singles and doubles. Don't go for the home run. And focus on protecting the equity in your farm.
What's the difference, Arland or Mike, and maybe both of you, between the quantitative easing that was used in 2008 and the amount of money that is being used for coronavirus? And is it simply about worldwide money supply in this case? And is there very much difference in the way you think it will potentially create inflation?
We've just dwarfed what we did in 2008. And the thinking at the Federal Reserve is, well, we didn't get inflation out of that, although I would argue that we did in some sectors. And so saying it must be safe. And at first, we heard from Jerome Powell, we're not here to make the markets happy. And after the markets threw a couple tizzy fits, he kind of changed his tune. And now he's saying unlimited resources. If that's the case, then why not send $1 million check to every American? We say, well, that's absurd because that would create such stimulus on the economy and inflation. Well, the truth is somewhere in between. There will be consequences. Interest rates will have to go up. That will create some problems, some real stress on our federal budget, with our federal deficit right now rapidly growing as well. And it's going to change the structure of our economy. It's going to change the structure of our marketplace when that happens. We just don't know when and in which asset classes it's really going to make itself most known.
Yeah, I'd say the only other thing, Todd, is the Fed paid the banks to hold money because they got paid more by holding money back during the financial crisis through the reverse repos and things like that. This time around, the Fed is essentially, and pretty much said it this last time they spoke, they've handed the monetary policy off to the government leaders and turned it into direct fiscal policy. So that's probably the biggest issue that we're going to have to contend with. The thing that trade is, I think, trying to figure out, and why they're short the agriculture. And I still look at this as pretty much a spread trade where they're long the metals, to a lesser degree, long the energies, long the equities, and have been for 10 years, and short the ag sector. Why would that be? Because we keep reproducing supplies, and because you get the Netherlands come out with their trade monitor this past week and said that so far this year in 2020, world trade's decreased 17%. So kind of goes back to what Arlen was talking about on the Chinese side of the equation with not creating inflation because of their domestic policy. I think the trade is looking at that globally, but I think they're probably in a situation where they're going to have to start to change their dynamic pretty soon.
I totally agree with that.
Well, I think another thing that is missing in our market right now, Mike, you talked about it being a spread trade, you know, where they're spreading against the commodities. One of the things that we're missing is we don't have the Dow Jones as high as it had been, and the returns are good. So there's no reason for them to come over here to actually try and earn money like they had been for quite a long time. You know, they were investing in commodities basically to back up earnings on the Dow. And we just don't see the need for that at this point in time. So I think until we either get back up to the high on the Dow and they maximize where they're at, or something else happens, that's a big component that's missing out of this market, is the outside investment money that was coming in here. And we do know that throughout this whole thing, we've lost a lot of the algorithmic guys. They've left and they're no longer in the marketplace. So it's going to take some time for things to come back, if they ever come back to the way that they were. I do believe we'll see people come in here and invest, but there's just some real key components missing from our ability to be able to have the type of volatility that we had in the past.
So they would all be part of volatility. However, Arlen, the marketplace always seeks what the balanced price should be. What should farmers take away from the conversation we're having? Is this a short-term conversation, a long-term conversation? Does it mean that they need to position themselves somewhat differently than they already are?
I think it's a long-term global situation, because it's not just our central bank, but it's central banks in all the major economies of the world that are doing this and moving forward. Again, we don't know the timing of it. We have to be somewhat defensive and have that kind of strategy in our marketing at the farm level. Focus on risk management, not hitting home runs. As we go forward, I agree with everything that both of the other guests are saying. And I think that day is going to come when the ag commodity, excuse me, going back to what we just talked about on the equity side, there's so much uncertainty how long that'll continue. It may continue to go well. It may stumble. If we have another big wave of coronavirus, then the equities could really stumble. And they say, well, where else can we go? But for that, you have to have demand for the commodities. But something they're going to be looking for some place where they can make money. And when that switch happens, if that happens, they're going to be looking at which assets give them the best opportunity. And I've done a lot of work over the years looking at the price regression studies for the price of corn, for an example. And if the funds are bullish the commodity sector, that can change the price of corn at the farm level by about 50 cents a bushel, up to there, anywhere from 30 to almost 60 cents a bushel, but 50 cents is a common number we see. And if they're bearish the commodity sector, it can lower it based on what the fundamentals would suggest, up to 50 cents a bushel. So what the funds think and what that sentiment in that money flow can make a big difference. So right now it's more bearish toward the ag commodity specifically. And so that's suppressing prices. That's the defense we need to play against. But that can turn, and we need to have the flexibility in our marketing plans to adjust when it does turn. We just don't know when that'll be.
Wait, Arlen, you just told me that the markets aren't free.
Well, it's all about...
I mean, you did, right? You did. I mean, the market sets a price, but if funds have enough money to raise or lower the price, and I can see them doing it temporarily, but in a more permanent sense, that's a whole different ballgame.
Well, if the funds are buying, that changes the perception. End users start to say, well, I don't see it. I think that the prices are too high, but they may go higher, so I better buy. And it just changes the behavior of the market. It's the lens through which the trade participants look at it. And so there's so much money involved in these markets, in the ag commodities, that's not going to change. So you have to learn to understand it and make it work for you rather than just get whipsawed by it. And work with it, and recognizing, are they bearish or are they bullish the commodity sector, helps you have a different perspective in looking at those fundamentals, because you see the colored lens through which they're looking at it, and the markets start to make a little bit more sense.
What I was just going to say is I couldn't agree with you more, Arlen, because I do believe the markets are free in that respect. And I think a lot of times what our farmers don't understand is the impact that they have on the market. As an example, you know, they forward contract something. They don't realize that the elevator is going to go out and sell a contract to protect themselves from having paid too much. You know, and so when they're lifting contracts, it helps lift the market. Because the commercial is buying back, they have a big impact on this market too. Many, many times, much more so than what a person might think, because their actions cause an action on the futures market. And I think if a farmer needs to learn anything, he's got to understand how that works. And one of the things we've been up against this year and last year too is all the government money that's been coming out, and the idea that we don't need to necessarily market. We're going to get this much from the government and we're okay. And we're going to get this much from, you know, crop insurance and we're okay. And that's not, that's really not the truth. And so that's another thing that I think when you would look at it from the farmer perspective, you have to be very cautious not to get caught up in the idea that, yep, we're going to get some money from them again next year. And it's going to happen again. And it's going to happen again, because that's not going to be the case.
Mike Suzalo, I want to round up at the end here. I think that each of you are telling me that producers need to know their cost. That's generally the case. They need to really have a good idea of what their yield is going to be so they know what the break even is, and to market accordingly. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, pretty much stating the obvious at $3 corn, but yes, that is correct. I the only thing I would say about our conversation, and this opens up a Pandora's box, I realize, but in my opinion, we should never have gone to negative $40 a barrel in crude oil, and we should never have negative interest rates. And so this is where the computers and the then and the algo funds and the investment flows have changed our markets forever. And it makes me feel as though that the farmer is 100% right when he says, I'm going to go build another bin. I think that's his only recourse, as long as he's got that bin paid for and his interest rates are locked down on it. Because what other ability does he have when markets get to this price level?
I'll ask for a final word, and I think, Mike, that may be yours, but I'll come back to you just to double-check from each of you. Arlen Suderman from StoneX, any final word for the day?
Well, Mike brought up a good point on interest rates, and as we look at interest rates, the Fed has said they're going to keep them, the short-term rates, as low as they can for as long as they can here, trying to keep the economy stimulated, and also reduce the amount of pressure on the federal budget deficit, where they're doing most of their borrowing in the near term. That doesn't mean the longer term rates can't go up and can't go up significantly. So look at your financing, look at what opportunities you may have for locking in long term interest rates, and whether that might be appealing for the long term health of your farm, and maybe fuel needs as well, because fuel prices can change much faster than you think with this money flow as well.
Jackie Vakes, your final word for the day?
What I've been trying to help people understand and think about is that we look at the market, and yes, this is not $4, $5, and $6 corn, but it could be a better price than they might actually get if we end up having some more back-to-back great, great production years. And so I think you have to put things into perspective. This is where we're at. And I'll go back to what Arlen said. Know what your break evens are. Know where you're at, and sit down and take the time to sit in an office and pencil it out, because you know right now with the way things are, it's easy to hide out in a tractor, or anywhere else away from what the markets are doing.
And finally, Mike Suzalo.
Locking in corn feed hedges here at this point, Todd, for livestock clients, and also starting feeder hedges at these price levels for the third quarter and beginning of fourth quarter marketings.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like at willag.org, willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Arlen Suderman of StoneX at StoneX.com. He's in Kansas City, Missouri. Jackie Vakes is at Total Farm Marketing, TotalFarmMarketing.com out of Hollister, Missouri. And Mike Suzalo at GlobalComResearch.com. That's GlobalCom with two M's, research.com. He is in Atchison, Kansas. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.